to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 987, and Mr. Senate President Brady Adams would like to address this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Wild. I appreciate the opportunity to come forward today in regards to support for Senate Bill 987 that originated with the Oregon Cattlemen Association. This bill is very similar to a bill that I had sponsored in 1995 and that this legislative assembly passed on both the House and the Senate, and unfortunately was vetoed by the governor. There is no question that the issue of dams and water rights and Oregonians' rights is becoming an increasing issue of controversy within the state. What this proposal would do is say that before a dam could be removed or that before the Water Resource Commission could require that a dam be removed, it would take legislative assembly approval. I think that that's important for us as an issue and a statement to make, and I think it's important for the legislative assembly to be involved in that decision making. We are the representatives of the people. The Water Resources Commission is not. It is not elected. It does not have to stand the test of the ballot box. It is not out working in the same way that an elected member does with its commission, with its constituents. So I believe that just as we are involved in education policies, as we're involved in public safety policies, as we're involved in health policies, that we ought to have a say when it comes to this important issue. I do have a couple amendments that I'd like to propose in regards to this, and this came up in 1995. It is not my intent to have the legislature be involved if there's a public safety issue, and that if there was a need for a dam to be impacted because of public safety, that we want to take care of that. So I do have some proposed amendments I'd like to bring forward. Basically, again, I just think this is good policy for the legislature to be involved with, and I would encourage the committee to consider it and hopefully recommend it and bring it to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. President. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Beckman?
Okay. Thank you. Yep.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dennis Beckman. I'm here today to represent the interests of the Savage Rapids Dam Task Force. You may recall that from my testimony last week on a different piece of legislation, I was actually here on behalf of my chairmanship of the Grants Pass Irrigation District. The Irrigation District is, of course, interested in Senate Bill 987. However, the purpose of my testimony today is to emphasize to the committee that the task force, which met throughout 1996 under my chairmanship, developed an extremely severe concern about the potential for adverse impact to the Rogue River in the event that Savage Rapids Dam were to be removed and the accumulation of sediments at Savage Rapids Dam was not studied and was not cared for in advance.
Dennis, let me ask you a question later on that subject. Did you do an initial drill of the sediment behind that dam down about 7 or 8 feet yourself?
In fact, I personally last year, the result of my concern for the failure of both state and the federal government to do a thorough sediment study, I personally funded through a foundation that I started last year called Sportfish Heritage, a study of sediments at Savage Rapids Dam that cost $75,000. I personally own the work product of that study.
How deep did you go there?
As much as 25 feet deep. Savage Rapids Dam is a classic example of the reason why great care needs to be used in advance of making a decision to remove an impoundment in the state of Oregon. The importance of following what I think are very intelligent mandates within Senate Bill 987, in effect it says, look, we as a state must impose upon those who are making the decisions the kind of study that is necessary to guarantee that the actions don't turn into a catastrophe. In the case of Savage Rapids Dam, there are approximately 1 million cubic yards of sediment that have accumulated above the dam since it was built in 1921. When the task force was created by Senate Bill 1006 and operated throughout 1996, it was not our understanding as a task force that we were really looking at a sediment problem, but that we were tasked with evaluating alternatives at Savage Rapids Dam. But as we continue to hear testimony, including testimony that is included within the document that I've distributed today, there was one in particular that really set us on ear. There was a gentleman by the name of Dishu Kartha. Mr. Kartha is a professional engineer from British Columbia who is the chief dam safety engineer for BC Hydro. That is the rough equivalent of the Bonneville administration in British Columbia. This is an organization that had removed dams.
And let me remind you, I've only got 2 hours. I don't have time to sit here and just let that one person dominate the conversation.
Okay.
So if you will, please, I'm going to try to give the rest of these folks on my list a chance to talk to
you. Thank you. Well, Mr. Chairman, the purpose of my testimony here today is to recommend an amendment to Senate Bill 987 that includes within 987 the provisions of a bill that had been previously offered in the House, House Bill 3346. 3346 mandates that a sediment study, a thorough sediment study, be conducted in advance of any decision that is made to remove a dam in the waters of the state of Oregon. The reasons for doing so are highlighted in the written testimony that I presented today, but fundamentally it comes down to assuring that in the process of making a decision to remove a dam or an impoundment, that we don't end up doing irreparable damage to the river or the body of water in which the dam is located. And that's really the essence of the findings of the task force. It is the reason why when I delivered the final recommendations of the task force to Governor Kitzhaber, that the task force recommended that the dam be retained and that it be renovated, because we were sincerely concerned about the potential for adverse impact to one of the 8 original wild and scenic rivers in the United States of America.
Primarily mercury deposits behind the dam.
There is a modest amount of mercury that was found in these samples, but we need to be aware of the fact that the Rogue River has a major mining industry that goes back into the late 1800s. There were in excess of 200 mines in the watershed above Savage Rapids Dam, about 50 of them mercury mines. And the reason for the mercury, of course, was to collect the gold. So if we have a situation where a watershed includes mining activities, if it includes heavy agriculture and the potential, for example, for the use of lead arsenic-type pesticides that went back into the 20s, into the 30s, DDT, we need to be sure that the sediments that are collected at any older structure does not include the kinds of biological agents and the kinds of heavy metals that potentially could cause a catastrophe downstream. I'm not here today to say that no dams should be removed. I mean, the object of my testimony today is to support Senate Bill 987 offered by the Cattlemen's Association from the standpoint of a group of people in my community who considered the options at Savage Rapids Dam for over a year under the auspices of Senate Bill 1006 and were worried about protecting our beautiful river.
Mr. Beckman, do me a favor, if you will. You suggested amendments from House Bill 3346. Would you provide the committee administrator with those proposed amendments?
I will do that.
Would you take a look at it? Questions to the committee? Senator Corker.
Mr. Beckman, do you... Do you think Mr. Kartha can have you described in your report as a professional engineer, was qualified to do the assessment that he did on Savage, on the potential dangers to savage grasses play in?
Well, in fact, Senator Kirkland, Mr. Kartha is
kind of a yes or no.
Yes.
Okay. And do you think that it's good to have trained technical people to do assessments of this sort?
Absolutely.
Do you think do you know how many engineers there are in the legislature?
I do not.
How many biologists there are in the legislature?
I don't know that either.
I was just trying to get us, I can't for the life of me understand why the legislative assembly would be the one to make an assessment that a dam should be removed, you know? I mean, especially in light of the listings and what we're dealing with, it seems counterintuitive to me that we get railed on. We rank lower than whale poop for most things that we do, and then you would put us in charge of a momentous decision like this. I'm just kind of flabbergasted.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kirkland, I think
Mr. Kirkland, is this your bill?
It is not my bill.
Okay.
The amendment to it is
different for the bill.
Yes. Ah, it is my bill.
Well, there's that.
You go ahead and ask your question. Right?
Senator Kirkland, we're obviously involved in an environment today which is overlapping in terms of jurisdictions. The Rogue has a coho listing under the Endangered Species Act. We have a variety of state and federal agencies that are involved in the Rogue River and the Rogue Basin. Issues about retaining or removing dams clearly are rising to the national level. I think there's every reason to believe that the state legislature should play the critical role in making determinations about dam removals in this state, because the first one that is removed is going to end up setting a pattern for others that will be removed in the future. And I think you'll hear from my companion today that there is a dam that had been removed about 10 years ago that is perhaps not the best example of the approach that the state of Oregon should take to protecting its waters. I mean, let us not forget that these are the waters of the state of Oregon and of the United States of America. These are not the local waters of the city of Grants Pass or Josephine County. And both the state and the federal government, in my view, should have responsibility for protecting these for posterity.
Okay. Mr. Reckling, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rydak, Mr. Bob Rydak.
Okay, I'm here to speak on behalf of the bill also. As Mr. Becklin indicated, I was involved actually in a couple different studies in the last 10 years that involved the removal of Val Fest Dam. One of those studies was for Botkin on the state. Excuse me.
Folks, can you come forward and testify? I'll always give us your name for record, please, and the microphone, Bob.
Okay. Bob Zydak from Corvallis. And I was involved in two studies that involved the removal of the dam on the Celeste River. One of those was studying the logging and salmon history of the Celeste Basin, and I studied the role of the dam in the 1921 flood, its failure at that time. And the second one was an oral history project with Celeste tribal elders. We questioned 17 or 18 older people in the Celeste community regarding environmental degradation. They were very concerned about the sharp decline in lamprey eel populations that coincided with the dam removal. They also reported declines in crawdads of crayfish, periwinkles, freshwater clams, salamanders, trout, beaver, mink, otter, raccoon, wildcats, and bears, as all occurring within a 10-year period that coincided with dam removal. Some of the people blamed the removal of the dam on these subsequent declines in local populations. Others blamed other factors, but all considered that it needed to be determined what the cause of the decline is and was. Secondary to that, in this instance, I understand federal dollars are going to be used. I'm an archaeologist. my understanding of the law is that if the federal government is involved, they need to do a coastal resource inventory for anything that disturbs the ground. I'm very concerned about the fact that not only are scientific studies not being required of sediment content, but scientific studies are not being required of local attitudes and values. We're not going in, we're going in subsequent and incidental in questioning tribal elders as to what effect this process has had on their lives. And some people report very negative impacts to themselves and the wildlife populations, and yet that doesn't even enter into discussion. So we need to develop baseline information, and it doesn't need to be limited to just biological concerns. It needs to be expanded, and maybe for legal reasons, to include cultural concerns.
That's a very valid point you raised. I would wonder, in terms of the Savage Rapids Dam, which indigenous folks you're talking about?
I'm talking about the indigenous folks that live there and pay taxes on the property surrounding the dam. Those people within the watershed.
I guess the local indigenous, I meant pre-American.
Those two. But
and which are they?
They would involve Paleo-Indian cultures all the way through, in that particular area, Athabascan peoples in early historical times, pioneer settlers, and certainly the people that originally put the dam in the 1920s, and current residents. So I don't think there's a time frame of impact, but certainly the devaluation would be living people that are there today.
Thank you, Mr. Roderick. Stonebrink.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Len Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Senate Bill 987, as written and in before you, I believe covers only part of the intent of when it was drafted, before it was sent to legislative council. And that, of course, was to put the legislative assembly in a decision-making, in the decision-making process prior to removal of dams or reservoirs within the state. Now, I have a -2 amendment that I have drafted, and I believe you have it there. But in the essence of time, I won't go through my original testimony on it, only to give you the background of why I drafted it. That amendment would ask for an inherent right of the state before dams are removed. And by inherent right, what would I mean by that? I went to the Corps of Engineers and went through their archives and found that under the Flood Control Act of 1944, that they recognized within that act that it was a policy of Congress to recognize the rights of the state and wanted the state to be in the consultation process prior to construction of any dams or reservoirs that they might put in. What I'm trying to imply with the -2 amendment is if the state had a right in the beginning of the construction, we would have the same inherent right, if you will, prior to their removal. And that, I think, I won't go into it unless you'd like me to. I could go through the documents that I handed out to you are the documents from the Corps of Engineers that that imply that. I know it's a photocopy and it's a little bit hard to read, but and you read it as you will. As I understand, you won't probably be voting on this amendment today. Okay. Just to conclude is that I would also, in that amendment, like to strike subsection 2 of section 3. So if you have it before you, it would be from line 13 on down.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Stonebrink? Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. George.
Chair Tarnow, members of the committee, and Larry George, Executive Director of Oregon Lands in Action. We're supportive of the Cattlemen's Senate Bill 987. And basically, what's happened is, as you can imagine, representing farmers, ranchers, and other rural landowners across the state, we're hearing a great deal of concern about talk about removing dams. We're also supportive of the -2 amendments that that Mr. Stonebrake has brought forward to you. Briefly, there's a huge impact when we're talking about removing dams to the uses that farmers and ranchers have on their property. And there's a lot of concern out there among rural landowners that some of these decisions, although originating in science, can be based on very much based on politics of dam removal. And so this would be a counterbalance and allow an open public discussion in this format, in this forum, to have a discussion and allow the elected representatives of the people to make the final determination. We think that'd be a positive step.
Mr. George, thanks for your question.
Thank you.
Before I forget, Mr. Stonebrake, when we bring this bill back, I'd like for you to have someone from Fish and Wildlife, fish biologists, to tell us what impact there would be to the fish populations downstream if a dam were to remove, if any. Give us an idea of what impact there would be, the sulfation or that kind of stuff.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Copeland.
As long as we're looking at research for change, that would help the legislature. What you might ask too, Glenn, is if there's various methodology of breaching the dam and what those may entail, and if there's any alternatives in terms of fish passage, to really get a full spectrum of the silt thing to me seems to be a function of part of the physics of draining the thing to some degree. Thanks very much.
Mr. Jeff Chiricud. What? How do you say that thing? Okay, thanks, Jeff. Good question.
Nobody else read my handwriting.
Jeff, please.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Fryer, and I'm representing the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club. I'm also employed as a fisheries biologist conducting research in the Columbia Basin Salmon, and I have a PhD in fisheries. Myself and the Sierra Club urges the committee to reject Senate Bill 987. The bill is unneeded, leaves a lot of questions, and is potentially could have a damaging effect on its efforts to recover salmon stocks. Our first problem for this proposed bill is figuring out what it means. It refers specifically to any dam or artificial obstruction that is greater than 10 feet in high, 10 feet in height. If a road crosses a stream on a fill over 10 feet high, would the legislature have to approve any order to replace an impassable culvert with a bridge? If the Water Resources Commission and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission require that a dam be removed, would the state legislature still have to approve it? If the Water Resources Commission decided that a dam was unsafe and ordered its removal, would the unsafe dam remain in place if the state legislature took no action? There seems to be a desire among many in the Pacific Northwest to blame everyone but ourselves for declining salmon populations. We prefer to blame ocean conditions, avian predation, marine mammals, and northern pike minnows or squawfish. Some seem to really believe that if we just kill a few predators, we can have all our dams, drain all our wetlands, divert most of the water from rivers, and still have salmon. The science is increasingly clear we need to have a more natural river ecosystem if we are to even maintain, let alone restore, salmon runs. The leading cause of declining salmon populations in the Pacific Northwest has been the building of hundreds, if not thousands, of dams. Many of these dams have long outlived their usefulness. If we are truly going to recover salmon populations in the Pacific Northwest, some of these dams will have to be removed. The legislature should be making it easier to remove dams, not more difficult. Therefore, myself and the Sierra Club urge this committee to reject Senate Bill 987.
Yeah, thank you. Question for the committee? Yep. Yeah, thank you very much. Okay. Martha?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Martha Pagel, Director of the Water Resources Department. We're handing out our written testimony on the bill. The Water Resources Department would be strongly opposed to this measure, for the same reasons that were brought forward when it was passed a couple of years back. And let me just go through them very briefly. I know you have a lot of business to cover today. First, by way of general background, our department, as you know, has general authority to regulate the construction, siting, construction, maintenance of dams from a dam safety standpoint. We also have specific authority with respect to hydroelectric facilities. This measure that you have in front of you, Senate Bill 987, is problematic from many different aspects. Our primary concern relates to the dam safety issues, and I heard the comments of Senate President Adams that he intends some kind of amending language to deal with dam safety or public safety. But that is a key concern. As this bill is written, it would take 18 months to 2 years before we could deal with the public safety problem, and that could be a major impediment to the public and something that we could never support. The bill is also very confusing as it's written. It would purport to amend a certain chapter of the ORS, Chapter 543. Well, that chapter deals with hydroelectric facilities. And if this proposal, as it's been described by its components, it doesn't seem like it was intended to cover hydroelectric facilities in particular. The wording of the bill, though, covers every structure. So it would be placed in the wrong chapter of the law, creating ambiguity as to what it's intended to cover. If it is intended to cover hydroelectric facilities, it creates some real conflicts with the comprehensive work that's been done by a task force over the last two interim sessions and major legislation relating to hydroelectric facilities and the potential for the possibility of decommissioning hydroelectric facilities. We've had a task force, a legislatively appointed task force, looking into that issue in the interim. They have a measure currently being considered on the House side, so there's potential for real conflict there. I wanted to respond just briefly to a couple of the points that have been made, particularly with respect to the issue on the Valsets Dam and the sediment questions and the safety questions. The Valsets Dam was removed in 1988 after what I think an objective observer would say was a very comprehensive process that did involve a great deal of public involvement. It was the first and only time that our department has exercised the public safety authority, the dam safety authority, to require the removal of the dam, and we did that in full cooperation with the dam owners. Public health, human life, and property were at stake in that situation. And there was an independent panel of engineers who worked with our state engineer to come to the conclusion that that dam needed to come out or needed to have substantial repairs in order to make it safe for the public.
And so where's the Valsets Dam? Where is it located?
Valsets was in the former community of Valsets and toward the coast from here.
Yeah. Was it a large dam, do you recall, or what was the size?
I can get that information for you. It was certainly within our authority of being over 10 foot high. It wasn't a whole lot higher than that. It did go through quite a bit of public involvement and public review as to how it should be removed in a way that managed the sediment. Anytime a structure is removed, you're going to have a sediment problem.
That was my question, Mark. Do you know if we had a problem after the dam came out with sedimentation going downstream, or if that was...
My understanding is that there was no long-range permanent damage. I'm not aware of these issues that have been raised about this. Consulting with tribal elders are not something that has ever been called to my attention before. And generally, the Valsets experience is viewed as a success in terms of having dealt with a public safety issue in a way that was expeditious but fair-minded toward the owner and that protected property and human life, potential for human life.
Cool.
With respect to the general issue of amendments dealing with the sedimentation studies or whatever, we've pretty much already covered that with other bills, but what we would say is that, yes, certainly the mechanics of how a structure would be removed are very important to consider. We wouldn't quarrel with that, but interrupting the state's ability to deal with either an illegal structure that has no business being in the river in the first place, or a structure causing public health and safety, are things that we would strongly urge the legislature to leave in the hands of an administrative body that can move quickly and implement the policy direction that you give us, but not inject the legislature on a case-by-case decision-making basis.
Okay. Thank
you.
Thank you. Oh, that's okay.
I'm sorry. I just want to get on the record that I was confused, too, about the notwithstanding, the placement of it in 543A, which is the reauthorization of hydroelectric project, and the Section 2, I'd like you to react to what your understanding of notwithstanding any other provision of Chapter 543 or 543A, you may not require. What do you understand that to mean?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I would understand that to mean notwithstanding any other provision relating to hydroelectric facilities, as they are what's covered in 543 and 543A.
And the difficulty that would present to you is?
Chair Senator Corcoran, with respect to hydroelectric facilities, there's a separate bill on the House side that would, that has a task force working on what would be the standards and process if and when a hydroelectric facility needs to be decommissioned. And this bill would sort of come in with a hammer and just wipe out the work of this task force, which is setting out a process, and that would also provide for coordination with FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, in the case of FERC license projects. It's a very complex and sensitive process, and we've had a task force that involved industry representatives, environmental groups, and agencies working together, and this would appear to override that.
And do you think we could get somebody from FERC to talk to us about the ramifications of this bill, the impact of this bill?
Chair Senator Cork, and I'm sure you could, and I suspect they would be concerned about what they would perceive as an encroachment on federal jurisdiction and responsibility.
Okay, thank you.
Martha, you have to note that House Bill number is earlier.
Yes, okay. Testimony.
Sure. I'm sure they're grandchildren.
The problem is I forgot my glasses.
Thank you.
Well,
good. Thank you, Martha. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Mr. Myers.
I think grandkids make your eyes look bad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Doug Myers, and I'm here today representing Water Watch and Trout Unlimited. And we arise in opposition to this bill. I think it's important to remind you, being an advocate of good government, Senator Tarnow, that we have a commission system. These folks that serve on boards and commissions in the state listen very carefully to the staff. They get paid even less than the pittance that you work for. Their decisions, I think, should be respected. And
they get paid what you say, Doug?
Even less than the pittance that you get paid. Really? Because you're being a state senator.
They, too, can get food stamps. Is that what you're saying?
That's true, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Myers, you got anything else you always say on this committee?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. That concludes the testimony, the sign-up for the folks on Senate Bill 97. Senator Corcoran, you had a question. May I butt in for the question of Mr. Stoneberg?
Actually, it was the 543 question. Maybe
okay.
If you could explain why you would insert it in there, that was my issue. You can explain it next time.
Next time. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 987. And what do we have next?
We have 1040.
We're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1040. And Ray, you want to explain to us what 1040 is, reference, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1040 requires notice of location of proposed facility to the owners of real property located within 1/2 mile of the proposed facility. And proposed facility defined within the bill includes but not limited to detention facilities, community corrections facilities, youth corrections facilities, juvenile detention centers, probation offices, et cetera, et cetera. It also defines, as I said, facility, specifies content of notice and creates cause of action for failure to comply with requirements of notice. Senate Bill 1040 refers the act to the people for their approval or rejection at the next general election.
Senator Courtney,
Senator Courtney, can we help you, sir?
No, I just want to see you here.
Oh, he's right here.
And
we're watching for you.
Senator Courtney, we have a prohibition in the rules of water and land use against ugly ties. Don't we, Mr. Chair?
Yes, we do.
Thank you.
Mr. Jack Peake, please. Mr. Peake, are you here? I have been informed, Mr. Peake, that you had a major part to play in the issue of thing about 1040, so perhaps you explain what your thoughts are.
Thank you, Senator Carno. I guess I did. Yes, I think that's correct. First of all,
for the record, your name, please, sir.
Yes, it's Jack Peek, and I live in the Foster Powell area of Southeast Portland. And I'm co-chair of the Foster Powell Neighborhood Association. And my wife and sister, sir.
Before you go too much further, let me indicate for those of you in a room where I aren't quite aware of this, a little bit of historical trivia. Today is April 15th, and we're here in Senate Bill 1040. I just wanted you to be aware of that. And I for Jack, I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you. I want to put in the record a copy of a letter that I received from State Representative Ida Balashotis, addressed to Senator Carno. Senator Carno, I'm writing to urge your support of Senate Bill 1040, an act relating to locating specified facilities. This is a similar measure, Senate Bill 6445, which unanimously passed the Washington State Legislature during the 1998 session. By way of background, I am co-chair of the House Committee on Criminal Justice and Corrections in Washington State. In this position, I have had the opportunity to become very familiar with the process of establishing and operating group homes for juvenile and adult offenders. The legislation which we passed had three main elements that I consider key in siting these facilities and protecting the neighborhoods in which they've been located. First, neighbors must be given advance notice and information regarding any facility that houses offenders. Senate Bill 1040 does an excellent job of providing this type of notification. In fact, I'm going to revisit Washington statute to see if our laws can be further amended to include some of the language in this bill. Second, when one of these facilities is established, it is critical that they are supervised 24 hours a day. Again, Senate Bill 1040 makes this clear. The third component, which I don't believe is in your bill, but may already be in the statute, is in regards to risk assessment. The supervising agency, which should have access to all records in a timely fashion so that they can complete a risk assessment prior to the individual being placed in one of these facilities. This enables the agency to address individual safety needs, to serve the offender effectively, to provide the individual with a placement with the best placement to assist them to successfully make the transition to non-offender status. I hope the Oregon Legislature gives this measure serious consideration, as I believe it will be effective in helping your state avoid the tragedies that have taken place in our state caused by poor siting, lack of supervision, and an incomplete risk assessment. Not only is she a state representative, she's a mother. And 9 years ago, her daughter was killed by a high-risk individual walking away from a work release facility. She knows this issue backwards and forwards. The reason that I got into this, Senator Carno and committee, is there is a PSRB home placed in my neighborhood. If you want to label me an enemy, I stand up and applaud. It is in my backyard.
Now, that PSRB stands for?
State Psychiatric Review Board. Okay. At the present time, there are five criminally insane gentlemen located there. They do have a caregiver for them, and at this time, they do have 24-hour supervision. It is a situation that I have researched top to bottom. Other states, and in some cases other counties and cities, have provided similar legislation that is proposed by this bill. The state of Washington has to come out on top, number one, because of its locale to us, and number two, because of a three-year history of terrible problems that they had up there, culminating with a 12-year-old girl getting raped and killed by a youth offender walking away from a facility. Representative Balashotis has reviewed this information that I supplied to her over the other states that I found with similar information and similar laws that had already been passed, and has shared with me that this idea needs to happen. Now, where my growth, I guess you could say, in this is when the facility was first cited, yes, I wanted it out. Secondly, when I got further down the road in understanding what you gentlemen have to assess in siting one of these facilities yourself, you have no funds to continue the state here where they were. You've lost the ability because of funds, I understand, to house them in a stronger facility on state grounds, and the neighborhood seems to be the only place to go. What I'm telling you right now is I'm in agreement with you. You don't have any choice. But what I'm asking you to do is to consider the safety of the neighborhoods, the impact of the neighborhoods, not only on the real people impacted by the sightings of these facilities. Property values plays a minor issue in this, but it's flat mathematically. The longer they're there, the potential for a total disaster really happens. So I got involved. I asked 80 neighborhood associations in Portland to support a concept of this bill that what it put for you, and I definitely have substantiation for all of that. A lot of people agree that they have to go someplace, and until certain issues and certain laws are changed, it's so complex. Federal Fair Housing Act, Americans with Disabilities Act, social service needs, but the people that live there need to be considered too. And I ask each one of you to consider your wife, your daughters, your sons, your grandchildren, who might be living with one of these facilities. Thank you so much for your time.
Great, thank you very much. Another question?
Yes, sir, I'm not done. Thank you. Since you're up here, why don't you address some of the concerns that are raised, for instance, by the Fair Housing Council with regard to the crossover problem that you run into with the American Disabilities.
Oh, yeah. Happy to. In the Act, privacy of these individuals is protected. The criminally insane have the right to privacy like any other individual placed in the neighborhood. There was an amendment placed before the Federal Judiciary Committee, H.R. 3206, which the City of Portland went on record, signed individually by each city councilman, and the mayor didn't sign this, opposing this. Now, this would have closed the loophole where it says five unrelated people can be called a family with one caregiver, and they can move into a neighborhood without any notification. Any family doesn't require notification moving in. So they fall under this commitment of the Federal Fair Housing Act. H.R. 3206 would have killed that amendment, or killed that loophole, and prompted further legislation in terms of location and siting. As a subheading to that 3206, one of the things that was in that act was a rider that would have protected the First Amendment rights of residents like myself from libel lawsuits and sanctions.
I'm losing you here. My question was, do you see any conflict in the bill with the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And I think that's something that we're willing to address and willing to negotiate because of the sensitivity and the outright good legislation that both Senate or the House or Federal Fair Housing and the ADA provide.
Okay, thanks.
Ellen Lowe. Ms. Lowe? Ellen C. Lowe?
She's here.
Okay. How'd you feel fine?
I hope that arrives at my goal.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I serve as Director of Public Policy of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. We are a religious organization of 16 denominations across Oregon and about 1,200 congregations that are part of those denominations. I come today with some real questions about Senate Bill 1040. As we have read it, because as we look at, and I'll start with some of the services that Ecumenical Ministries itself is directly involved in, we see these covered by this act: our HIV Day Center, our Hopewell House, full-time socialization program, an alcohol and drug treatment program for pregnant women and women with children, Oxford Houses, parent mentoring, mental health clinic. Many of our congregations are involved in shelters, in food pantries, and food kitchens, and it's rare when you find a congregation in Oregon that is not involved in counseling. So as we look at Senate Bill 1040, and it describes facility, we wonder if indeed what you're saying is that it means any space that is used for the treatment, rehabilitation, detention, monitoring, or counseling of a person. And when you list the individuals who would be covered, it would include someone who at one time or another had been convicted of a crime. We do not ask when someone comes for counseling, or most of us do not, if they have ever been convicted of a crime. So as we look at the requirements for notification, does that mean that we need to notify that we indeed do not ask some of these questions who may be presenting themselves to us, or one of our services for counseling? For example, line 14, it mentions someone who is participating in any drug rehabilitation program that may not be one of ours, but they may be participating in drug counseling and then be presenting themselves for some other services. And so when we look at such language as you have in line 15, includes but is not limited to, we have some serious questions about how far-reaching this particular piece of legislation really could be. As I just heard it described, it seemed to be talking about people who were currently in many ways still part of a state system, whether it be corrections or mental health. But I would strongly suggest that if you examine this very carefully, that really in many ways would include almost every congregation and almost every not-for-profit in this state that involves itself in service to the poor, the vulnerable, and the voiceless, because many of them may have in their background participation in a drug rehabilitation program, or they may have something in their criminal record. I also wish to call to your attention for some research on your part, and that is the size of the bonds that would be required. Most of the services and groups that I'm associated with, I think that would be prohibited. And when I look at the advertisement that is required, back again in lines 26 through 28 on the first page, I think that most of us, if we involved ourselves in advertising, it would be letting folks know that we're available to help them. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Ms. Lowe, thank you very much. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not questions, but it's to the bonds. I went both to the national organization that involves itself in these types of bonds, and I went to state insurance agencies to ask what is considered a standard size bond and under what conditions, such as it was pointed out to me, definitely have maximum deductible of $25,000, and that would be standard across the country. And they thought that was not at all out of line, and I did not want to put something down that was out of line. And I did check both J.D. Fulweiler in this state, which is the leading company for writing these types of bonds. I wanted to make certain that I said, give me an extreme. Actually, what I originally asked for, they said, no, we We will not do that. It will be far too difficult to obtain that bond. That would be unreasonable. And they brought it back to what they said. This would be considered very standard. So that is what I put in. But there definitely was research involved in it.
Sure. Ellen, I have a question for you, but I want to ask some wild questions first. Senator, when you talked to those folks on the bonding, did they give you ballpark figures for what they had to bond
in? They did. It's not in this packet, but yeah.
Senator Paul, just generally?
I told them that I didn't want it to go over $5,000 a year.
$5,000 a year?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it begs the question, you know, of the organizations that you work with, how many of them have the capacity or the budget to spend $5,000 a year on bonding? But I'm not going to ask you that question. The question I have, Ellen, is really, you know, I think Senator Wild gets at some very important issues here in terms of just reasonable protections for children. In the siting of these facilities. I really don't have a lot of objection to it. But I wonder if, in your opinion, there's a way to salvage this bill and retain the elements of it that are of concern to Senator Wild with regard to, you know, not siting facilities within a third of a mile of a school or a child care facility that housed certain kinds of folks, and not citing people in residential areas, because I'm a little confused about where you cite them otherwise. But is this a bill that could be worked on and made acceptable, do you think?
Mr. Chair and Senator Carpenter, there has been another bill that has been introduced, I believe Senator Kate Brown, and where it's in judiciary, where maybe that would be a place perhaps to deal with some of the ADA issues and some of the privacy issues. One of them, and again going back to some of the concerns that I raised, just the way facility is described here, it really needs to say. I'm wondering if Senator Wild really did mean counseling services, and I'll use my own neighborhood as an example. I live in Kings Hill. Many of those older homes that are part of the historic register house psychologists, clinical social workers, psychiatrists. And they do counseling, and they do counseling with some of the individuals that have been mentioned in this bill. I somehow would question whether or not, or at least as the previous speaker spoke, if it's that kind of facility that he's really concerned about. But this bill includes that, as I read it. And so so I think it would be extremely important for that to be looked at. There's such another example would be the program. That
Ellen, really what I was asking was, do you think the bill can be worked or not?
As it's currently structured, I think it would have to be a gut and stuff.
Mr. Chair, so the other question I have for you, Ellen, if you drew this third of a mile around every school and child care facility, and you excluded from residential areas in those following categories that are on page 2, can you sort of have a mental map of Portland and sort of describe what would be left to house anybody? I mean, would this be just basically a means of not allowing released inmates to go to the Portland area?
I think it, Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, it occurs to me that it would be very, very exclusionary, particularly because this, again, the bill doesn't just include residential areas.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lowe. John McCauley.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley, representing the Oregon Psychiatric Association. And I have to tell you, I had some of the same issues that Mrs. Lowe had as she was presenting her testimony, because it just conjured up in my mind some of the facilities here in Salem where some of our members are located in homes that have been renovated and turned into offices. So the issue involves the definition of facility and people who may go to those facilities for psychiatric treatment. And as I would understand it, that may not have been the intent of the bill drafters, but it appears that just because of the way facility is defined, it does include those private offices who may treat the clients who are listed in the bill.
Could I respond? Because this does have a history to it. And the history is that in North Portland, we had a probation office cited with no notification given. And the rationale on the part of the city of Portland for zoning aspects was that a probation office, they considered to be office use. And so they got around the need to have any notification of any kind or any public hearings because they merely stated that a probation office was an office. It was not a detention facility in any way whatsoever. And so, yes, you have to play by the other side's rules, you might say, and they set the rules. If they hadn't pulled something like that, in all likelihood, I wouldn't go this route. But knowing the way they play, I am going to play by their rules. And I'm going to include offices.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wilde, and that, I guess, cements where our position would be relative to the bill. We would have to, of course, oppose it just for that reason. It, to me, seems unreasonable for a private business, and the psychiatrists are a private business, having to go through this to locate to treat people. And I think it extends beyond psychiatrists as well. Because it could include dentists or anybody else who provides services to somebody who may be one of these people on the list. I think it has pretty far-reaching consequences.
Mr. Collins, thank you very much. Appreciate it, John. Janet or Inns?
Good afternoon. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. The Alliance is a statewide nonprofit organization that is an alliance of over 200 community programs around the state. We have, in fact, programs in each of the areas of the members of this committee, including Bob Baloney Ranch and Tuesday, Catholic Community Services here in the Salem area, Salem Youth and Family Services in Newburgh, Janus Programs in the Portland area, and Looking Glass and Scarsdale Mountain in the Lane County area. And in addition to that, I am a constituent of Senator Wilde in North Portland. I thought Ellen Lowe provided some really nice comments that were consistent with what our concerns were when we took a look at the bill. The intent of the bill, when we went through and read it, appears to be to address the public safety issues or concerns that community members might have about people with substance abuse issues who have been charged or convicted of crimes and what potential impact they may have on communities they move into. It also attempts to hold accountable in the strict system for anyone who wants to bring those individuals into a community. Our concern is, while we're sympathetic with those concerns, and we do address them specifically in our programs and in the kids and youth that we bring into them, we're concerned about the potential impact of the bill and the actual effects. It appears to discourage anyone from providing any kind of services to a very broad range of individuals, adults, youth, and children. Treatment's often mandatory. The hope is that people who have problems will seek on their own counseling and treatment. But the state of Oregon itself, on one hand, or local counties or jurisdictions may be requiring treatment to be provided to individuals, and on the other hand, may, through the course of this bill, be taking away any opportunity or any location for an individual to receive treatment. And this could be domestic violence counseling, treatment that's mandated by courts, that is in motor vehicles, has mandatory diversion and counseling programs for substance abuse, might be employer required or mandated. Hospitals could be affected by not only our community programs, but private providers, individual offices, hospitals, facilities like Trinity Lane in Lynn County. If Betty Ford wanted to open up a facility in Portland, it probably wouldn't be able to locate in any city or metropolitan area under these provisions in the bill. Schools with who have counselors may run into trouble trying to be in compliance with this bill. Even law enforcement, their program could be impacted by this bill. The consequences are misplaced. We have to be careful to balance the concerns of the community and their safe, public safety issues with the needs and the mandates of the state of Oregon and its citizens. And I don't believe that this bill has struck that appropriate balance. So for that reason, we can't support it.
You make assertions, and I'd like something to back it up. Could you tell me what wording in here specifically is, especially the DARE program? I mean, I want to go through, and I want to see where the wording is. If something needs cleaning up, I want to be able to clean it up. And it's hard to do on a generalized statement. So.
Thank you. Chairman Tarno and Senator Wilde. It talks about chemically dependent individuals and drug rehabilitation programs.
I don't think DARE is necessarily part of that program, though, is it?
Well, that's what my concern is the definitions are very broad. The bill in its entirety is pretty broad-reaching, and it's a little vague in places, so it makes it difficult to determine what programs could be affected.
I understand you're coming from somewhere well. I don't think Gary Rose will put in the general special, especially if you're not a school functioning up to your programs. Okay, I'm going to cut short if I can. I've got a lot of folks to get out of here before 3 o'clock, and I'm going to try to get through my list the best I can, so I would ask you folks to try to keep it as concise as you can. I'm not trying to cut you off, but try to keep your testimony as to the point as possible.
Succinct.
Thank you very much. Mary Claire Buckley.
Good afternoon, Senator Tano, members of the committee. My name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I am the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. I am here today to testify on behalf of the board in strenuous opposition to Senate Bill 1040 on both legal and policy grounds. Some of the concerns the board shares have already been expressed, but my comments now will be directed specifically to the board and its function. As I'm sure you are aware, the Psychiatric Security Review Board is the state agency that assumes jurisdiction over all those found guilty except for identity of a crime by a judge or jury who may present a substantial danger to others. Its mission is to protect the public through an ongoing review of the progress of those found guilty except for insanity and to determine their appropriate placement. The board was created by the legislature in 1977 as a unique experiment to deal with the perceived problems involved with handling those who had asserted the insanity defense. Its framework was a thoughtful and deliberate result of the findings of two separate task forces, one in mental health and one in corrections, that had carefully studied the issue. It was designed as an independent, multidisciplinary board that would hold hearings to decide the appropriate placement of these individuals, be it committed to the state hospital in a secure forensic ward, released to a highly structured, supervised situation in the community, or be discharged totally. The enabling statute directs the board to have as its primary purpose the protection of the public.
Mary, how much are you going to read to us? How much are you going to read to us? How many GF pages or?
Yes, a few pages.
Okay, would you get a copy of that testimony and
I will do that.
If you ask it, summarize it if you would, please.
As you said, the primary purpose is to protect the public. That is still the board's focus. Currently, there are 500 individuals under the board, of which 200 are living successfully in the community. It is the board's position that these folks are not criminals in the usual sense of the word, that these persons are suffering from mental illnesses who, as a result of that illness, a direct result of that mental disease or defect, have committed a crime. They have been remanded to the board's jurisdiction for treatment. The idea that the board is letting imminently dangerous individuals loose in our communities is ludicrous. The board takes its mandate to protect the public very seriously. It goes through a comprehensive process after an individual has been through the treatment process at Oregon State Hospital. The individual is then assessed by county mental health agencies for an independent evaluation as to whether they agree with the hospital that the individual is ready for release. And then the board again reviews the matter and makes the determination and approves the plan in all conditions that the individual must comply with if they are to live in the community. Once released, we keep very close tabs on them. We have a lead terminal in our office that tracks any law enforcement contacts. We have daily contact with case managers. And this is not a program that just lets people run wild in the community.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to add point to butt in, you might say. Did we not just have someone wandering around Salem recently? I saw it in the papers. A rather dangerous person, as I recall, who was wandering around freely.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, that individual was not on conditional release. He was a resident in the state hospital with privileges granted by the hospital to walk the grounds and did run away and was on unauthorized leave from the hospital. The board had not approved his conditional release.
But the fact is, as some of the fact is that some of these facilities, there is not full-time 24-hour-a-day staffing. I mean, of awake staffing, is that not correct?
Senator Wild, that is correct. Not all our, clients live in 24-hour supervised facilities. But what our concern is that this bill basically would prohibit the board from releasing most anyone under our jurisdiction. In both the who and the where, if you notice the crime classifications listed in the bill, that comprises 80% of our population. And that's because most individuals who charge with minor offenses do not associate any offense because being placed under the jurisdiction of the board is considered to be much more onerous than the sanctions that you might receive in the criminal justice system. Secondly, almost all of our clients live in areas zoned for residential use. And as Senator Corcoran mentioned earlier, I'm not sure where else one would expect clients to live. The purpose of conditional release is to reintegrate our clients into society. They need to be in areas where they can access the treatment services that they need, including mental health clinics, AA meetings, vocational opportunities.
No, you're going to have to wrap it up. I'm serious when I say a lot of folks get through this committee meeting.
Well, the effects of eviscerating this ability to condition release our clients, I think, is not just to our clients, but to the public. Frankly, Senator, what the board sees is that with this bill, we couldn't release anybody into a supervised situation, but yet we could let individuals go live independently. And the board's position is that it is much safer for the public and more beneficial to our clients that they be allowed to live in supervised residential settings where people can monitor their medication, notice when their symptoms of their mental illness may be coming active, and can notify the board. The board has the mechanisms to revoke individuals immediately if they either violate the conditional release or their mental health deteriorates such that they pose a substantial danger.
Mary, thank you very much. Will you get a copy of testimony to staff for so we can get copies made for everybody? Thank you. Sharon Bizzo? And Sharon, I know as always you can be very short and full sight and concise. I know you have a ability to do that.
No, I've got it.
It wouldn't move
Mr. Chair and Chair and members of the committee, my name is Karen Bazon, Deputy Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. My written testimony is coming around. I won't read it. I do ask that you read it because I think I bring up some points that are broader in social policy. We have basically two concerns about the bill. The primary one that affects our agency is the requirement in the bill that prior to establishment of a community-based program intended to serve our clients, that we would have to do in some cases, have to do an impact study. About 40% of the youth authority's budget goes into community-based programs and money going to private providers who operate private businesses. We think that requiring us to engage with those private businesses prior to even establishing a contractual relationship with them blurs the line between public and private. And we've actually been pretty proud of having 40% of our budget going into this privatized kind of situation. And the bill as it's written, we think, puts us in an awkward position, and probably at the other state agencies too, if they have thought about it to that level. The other points in my testimony are that I'm not here to tell you that there isn't a problem in the state. I think that there is. I think it's larger, though, than just one group of individuals who are impacted by the problem, that being the neighbors, the kind of regular clients or regular citizen neighbors. In fact, I think the clients that we're trying to serve, as well as the agencies that are trying to serve them, are impacted by the problem. I don't think this bill solves the problem. It just responds to the problems of the citizen neighbors. The whole point of moving members of our society who have deviant behaviors, and in this bill primarily law infractions, back into supervised programs in the community, is that generally there are better outcomes, and generally those programs are cheaper to operate. What has happened in some populated areas is there has been a concentration of these kinds of programs that has made it not a very good situation either for the neighborhoods who live there, or for the clients, or for the agencies trying to site these programs, or for the agencies who have a responsibility for the kids. I'm not any happier having a group of youth offenders living in a neighborhood that has a methadone clinic down the street and a parole office up the street. I would prefer to have five delinquent kids living in a standard neighborhood where they're dealing with law-abiding, sort of everyday, typical people. What is driving this concentration, I believe, is something that could be handled by local government in establishing opportunities and incentives for these private providers to locate in more normalized fashion. I don't think I'm speaking to Senator Wild's concerns about notification and notice. I think that is something different, and I can appreciate that. But I do think we have competing public policies kind of clashing together here, and this bill only addresses one party.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Karen. Is it Barney Cast? Is there a Cast?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Barry Cast. I'm the Administrator of the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. Thank you for the opportunity this afternoon.
Well, I trust you two can kind of be as short as you can.
I have submitted written testimony. I won't read it. In some respects, it repeats some of the themes that you've heard today, but I wanted to bring up something a little different. We are living, for better or worse, in an era of community care, driven not just by cost, but also by federal law, by case law, and so forth. And this legislature has reaffirmed that policy probably on four occasions with respect to services of our agency, and we do provide services to people under the supervision of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Because of that, we are respectful of the concerns of neighbors. the times when we've gotten into real siting difficulty are few and far between. And when that happens, it represents, I think, a significant failure in our responsibility to the community to make a placement in a way that is compatible with the community and the needs of our clients. That's why I think the legislature put us in a partnership with county government. County governments are responsible for assisting us in this process. In effect, by accepting or refusing to provide service, they have a veto over anyone that we want to place in the community that they deem to be a danger to the community. Every siting that we do involves county representatives directly accountable to elected public officials and who have as part of their mission protecting the public interest. Placements can be blocked, as I said. But the best reason, I think, for opposition to the bill is that under the circumstances in this bill, this effort at providing community care would come to a grinding halt. And as Karen Brazil pointed out a moment ago, the best chance we have for rehabilitating people and getting them back into the community, because we cannot sustain them in institutions forever, is to provide an opportunity for supervised living in the community that will meaningfully give us information about their improvement and their readiness for full community participation. The PSRB is the envy of many state forensic psychiatric systems. The PSRB has one of the best track records in the country. We have almost no record of neighborhood failure in the system, which has been operating since 1978. There are rare cases of reoffense, and any problem that arises, subject to someone who is under the supervision of the PSRB, is remediable by immediate revocation and rehospitalization at Oregon State Hospital. There isn't any place I know of that has as tight a law as the state of Oregon. And risk assessment is the key mission of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Getting out of the hospital is the tough part. And I think if our systems of corrections and other social service systems had the kind of record the PSRB had, we would indeed not be here today. What we have, as Karen pointed out, are policies in conflict, community care versus the interests and fears and anxieties of people who live in the community. And I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that that is going to be the subject of a long debate. Until that debate is resolved, I think we're going to be facing this kind of concern for the future. From the point of view of an administrator, we will do everything we can to prevent that kind of conflict from surfacing in any neighborhood in the state.
Mr. Cass, thank you. Thank you, Barry. Mr. Chandler. Chandler here. Susan Lindsay.
Mr. Chair, the members are asking to be brief, as a thing, not short. I have a different conversation.
That's amazing.
I understand.
Hi, my name is Susan Lindsay, and I'm presently the land use chair for the Buckland Community Association, the Neighborhood Association, and Inner Southeast Portland. And I'm here today, I just found out about the hearing yesterday, and I was able to break away from work to come down here. I think this is great, and I fully support this, and I'll tell you why, and I'll be brief and succinct. It's all about accountability. The Oregon voters in the last few years, and actually nationwide, have asked for more accountability from persons who have committed crimes, whether they committed crimes due to deviant behavior or because of mental illness. It doesn't really matter. The fact is we need to be protected from those people, and those people need appropriate treatment. The problem is that when we've set up a system of more prisons, there hasn't been enough room or facilities, and those aren't always the appropriate places to put people, and I agree with that. But what has to happen and has broken in this system here is that the persons are being housed in the neighborhoods, and the neighbors themselves are then ending up being accountable for their actions or for the mismanagement of those facilities. I'm sure some of the facilities really do a good job of maintaining close supervision. Others don't, and in fact, I have a couple of problems. I think just the minor things I'd like to say about this, what I've read, the draft I've read. In the first part, you required notice of location of the proposed facilities to all of the owners, and I would suggest to do it to the tenants, too. In our neighborhood,
perhaps 85% of the people that live in our neighborhood are renters, and oftentimes long-term renters. They are greatly impacted by these facilities, too, and they deserve to know about it also. And the other thing I wanted to say has to do with supervision, because that also happened in our neighborhood, that while a couple of times with a couple of OIA facilities, we were promised 24-hour supervision. But on closer review, we found out that that didn't mean that the people were actually being watched. It meant that maybe they would phone in a few hours later, or that they were out in the neighborhood doing who knows what, but nobody was actually watching them. It also meant that a person might be asleep at night, and that counted as supervision, even though the people at the facility were out or were sometimes asleep. So I felt that there were a couple of concerns I had that I would want to address that maybe makes this even a little stronger. But in terms of why I think it's flawed, I think it's particularly flawed that the neighbors are put into a position where if there is an accountability issue with how these are run, there's nobody really to turn to. You can't really turn to the OIA if you have a problem with the youth facility, because the OIA basically says, well, you know, we're just contracting to these private contractors and that's our system and we're not really involved with them. You've got to go to them. But they're not necessarily in any, there's no real reason or incentive for them to do anything for you either. So it really puts the neighbors in this position where they feel like either they have to put in the security system, or they have to, set up neighborhood watches all the time. Or we're told, and we have been told by persons at the facilities, that we need to just call the police. But, you know, the police are overburdened. So I just think that what this does is that it's fair. It's finally fair, because everybody's protected here. The mentally ill are protected by the system that we have. The youth offender is protected. The adult offender is protected. The agencies are protected. But right now, the neighborhoods aren't protected. If we had this in place, I would not have to have spent the last year of my life fundraising funds in order to try to block a facility that was coming into my neighborhood about a block and a half from my house, three blocks from an elementary school, with some very serious offenders. And I had to spend all that time and raise all that money in my spare time. I mean, that's not what I do for a living. I just do it as a volunteer. But if I had this, I wouldn't have worried, because I would have known that facility was accountable. That's what it's about.
Tell me the name of your neighborhood again.
The Buckman neighborhood. It's in inner southeast Portland.
Inner southeast Portland. Can you give me the dimensions of it?
It goes from the Willamette River east to 28th Avenue. From Hawthorne.
What the mileage was?
85 miles east and west, and it goes from Hawthorne Boulevard to Burnside, so approximately 2 miles north and south.
So 5 miles by 2 miles, and how many child care facilities and schools are in that area?
Well, the first part, an entire half section of the neighborhood is actually sort of a protected industrial zone. So the residential area is really from 12th Avenue up to 28th. And within that area, there is one elementary school, and there's a... Thank you. I think... Another person can speak probably more to the exact specifics of how many schools there are.
Well, in essence, it's just that it would be impossible to place any of these people in your neighborhood.
Well, listen, that's based on my sense. I did not say I was a mileage expert, so I don't know based on, because I can't tell you for sure that it's...
Well, it's a third of a mile for one category and no placement for another category.
It's a third of a mile away from a school. Correct?
And
child care facility. And child care facility. No, I think there would still be places to put things in our neighborhood. I didn't buy that argument at all. I think there's still probably plenty of room to put these places in. But even if that needs to be tweaked, maybe that needs to be tweaked somewhat if that's really a concern. But the important part about the bill, people must be notified and the agencies must be accountable. And right now they're not. They're not accountable.
Susan, thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Mr. Chandler. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Government Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on Senate Bill 1040. You've heard a lot of on the specifics of the bill. I won't address the committee notice implications, although I do want to compliment Senator Wilde on a good effort. It may have some work to do yet on it, on trying to handle a very touchy issue. In my citizen role. I am a resident of Southwest Portland, and we're having a tussle right now with an adult bookstore. It is a hard issue for neighborhoods to deal with on how to cite things of that sort. But I want to address the land use implications here. You heard a bill, a couple of bills earlier in this session, I don't recall the exact numbers, trying to deal with this issue through the land use system. I think that this bill you have in front of you is a much better approach. Rather than try to do it through the zoning code, do it through a system of notification and making people aware of these uses. And the reason I want to make sure that's on the record is because I think it's going to be increasingly, as the cities increase density, we are looking more at these urban issues, the temptation is going to be that they're trying to do it through the zoning code, and it simply isn't a very good tool, which means that we do have to look at approaches such as this as a way of getting necessary community facilities cited in a way that lets the people in the neighborhood know what's going on, but it also allows the social programs to continue operation. We support the bill. Thank you very much. Any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Chair? Sure.
Okay. So, John, you know about housing costs in Portland. I agree with you on the notification. I'm with Senator Wild all the way on that. But I'm concerned about the implications of the third of a mile for one group and no siding in residential areas for the other group. Would that have an impact in terms of where in Portland you would have to particularly cite these things, like in which quadrant?
I'm not sure I follow the questions in the quadrant. Are you, is there a section of town that is more likely to get these?
Yeah, or less likely. Either way.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to program off the top of my head. I don't think so, but I would. I'm trying to envision the map in my head. And I think that issue of the distance, and you're here, Seth, more from people that are far more knowledgeable than I am about that. That is, I think, there's some, that may be problematic. I think some of the definitions may be problematic. I would encourage you, though, that this is an important issue to be dealt with to make sure that those facilities are, you know, allowed to go forward, but in such a way that it doesn't affect neighborhood stability and integrity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will say this. What I'll do is, because hearing the testimony, I'm going to go back home, take out my big city map, sit down with a compass for 1,500 feet, and spin it around each and every educational facility, just that alone, and see what I'm looking at. Make a decision as to whether that's a reasonable thing.
Let you do that in your own time. That's fine.
Yeah.
John, thank you very much.
If I can't,
Andrew Eigen.
I might as well not even consider
Mr. Nisbet, is Andrew also with you?
We sit down together then.
That's fine.
My name is Andrew Eisen, and I'd like to address many of the concerns Senator Cochran has raised. I consider myself an expert on the issue of siting. So does the mayor. So does Karen Grizel, who I've actually met with her in OIA. I believe the Fair Housing Council would also argue I'm an expert on siting, having spoke to the director at the last meeting of which I was a representative on the Mayor's Council on Siting. I also spoke as a representative for the neighborhoods in Southeast Southwest Forum on Siting. I'm past chair of Buckman Community Association. I've lived in Buckman for 9 years. The gentleman he spoke to ended up in Buckman when he was arrested. If you're worried about saturation and proximity to schools, let's worry about Buckman. Where I live across the street from a facility that has 9 kids who've committed felonies. They're across the street from a facility that has 5 kids that committed felonies. They're 2 doors down from a facility that has 2 kids that committed felonies. They're around the block from another group home that has 3 kids that committed felonies. They're 3 blocks from Janet Youth Project that has 10 kids that committed felonies, which is 1 block from another Janet Youth Project that has 10 kids from a felony. We have 70 facilities in Buckman like this. This is absurd. Why did it happen in Buckman? I'll tell you why. Because Buckman's a poor neighborhood with no political clout. 85% of our neighborhood's renters, 20% live below poverty, 70% live below the median income in the neighborhood. The map you're talking about has been drawn. Yes, there can still be facilities in Buckman. Buckman has gone on record only opposing 2 facilities in my 6-year history being on the community association. This is not an issue of not in my backyard. This is an issue of trying to get some accountability for state, federal, and local facilities. The city has tried to address this issue. and hasn't really done a very good job. The county has tried to address this issue. Neither of those bodies have come up with any rules or regulations to control them. Many of the issues you raised, Fair Housing Act, I could address it. Ninth and Sixth Circuit Court have addressed it. I'm sorry, Ninth and Eighth Circuit Court have addressed it. They said that any state and local municipality is allowed to have regulations on the book that control corrections. As I read the regulations, this is an issue about people who committed crimes. Therefore, it's an issue around controlling corrections. There's been no Supreme Court or Ninth or Eighth Circuit Court decisions in our review of the law, which has been quite extensive, both by a paid attorney and two paid paralegals. And we have posed that information to the city attorney, and no one has ever come up to show us that we're missing any state regulations. I spoke to the Fair Housing Council director. They, too, said around the issue of juvenile facilities where kids are still serving out their term, those facilities are not covered by the Fair Housing Act, because the Fair Housing Act has a term that says if a person is deemed a threat to themselves or society, they're not covered by the Fair Housing Act. I don't see what the problem is. We've got a real problem here. Buckman's been on record complaining about saturation for 15 years. City, county, and state governments have done nothing. It's about time someone's willing to stick their neck out.
Mr. Eisenman, I think you're very passionate about this subject. Harry Intel, would you do me a favor? Put this in writing and get it to this committee.
Be glad
to get it out to our membership.
I have volumes of information to support what I
thought. I'm not asking for
more. I'd also like to just say that our representative, Earl Blumenauer, recently wrote a letter to HUD and CC'd Buckman. In it, he stated that Buckman neighborhood is the most saturated neighborhood of social services in the state, if not the country. And this, in fact, might be a violation of our constitutional rights, as has been determined in the recent Supreme Court case of, what was it? It was the city of Detroit against the Department of Interior for citing toxic waste dumps in Portland. It's a clear effort for everyone to say, oh, siting's not our problem. It's a private business. Oh, we didn't know they were going to go there. We've got real problems. We've got gang fights between these facilities. We've got real serious problems that aren't being dealt with. We need notification. We need to be able to address the concern.
Thank you very much. Cool.
I mean, this is exactly what I want to find out about. My concern would be that the NIMBY, you're sort of reverse NIMBY. You've got them all over your backyard. My concern is that that these kinds of regulations would move to create that kind of saturation and not have those facilities sited in high-end areas. We just witnessed in Eugene the siting of a low-income housing in the South Hills, and those people just raised holy hell.
Right,
yeah,
and that's a real concern. And what Buckman is, I mean, our problem is we're a poor neighborhood, and so therefore everything comes here. There hasn't been any political clout. What has happened, and what I think this 15-minute probably came from, Senator Brown actually came up with a similar figure, the citing of methadone clinics by federal regulations need to be 1,500 feet from a school, and I think that's where that number came from. I'd have no problem shortening that distance. I'd also, from my knowledge of Buckman, there would still be many facilities in Buckman, and I'd actually argue that I would, and I've talked to OIA about this, while I'd like to see decrease in saturation, we're not at all proposing just closing facilities. I'd like to see some really, you know, we're as concerned about the people getting care as we can be. That is a big concern. We've always welcomed facilities like this.
Thank you very much.
This isn't about
Andrew, for record,
Knesset, your name? I'm a resident of Buckman. I also became involved in this with the struggle with one of the current OIA facilities. The fact of the matter is that this is not a NIMBY issue. This isn't a neighbors versus clients issue. This is an attempt on the part of the neighborhood to get government agencies to behave with something resembling responsibility. It is clearly easier for the various government agencies if they don't have to tell anybody what they're doing, if they don't have to tell anybody when they're doing it, if they don't have to tell anybody why they're doing it, and if when they screw up, they're not held responsible. Making them let people know what they're doing, why they did it, and giving some method so that they are accountable when they did it will make their job more difficult. But I don't see that any of those things are particularly onerous or things that shouldn't be imposed on the people that we are entrusting, both with the clients and with the safety of our neighborhoods. And I'm also strongly in favor of the bill. Andrew, thank you.
Mr. Bob, John Depp, I wish you guys would write better, you folks and ladies.
Maybe he's a doctor.
You know, it might be. It might be a phenomenon. Are you a doctor?
Now you're messing with an attorney.
That's probably even worse.
I'll get to the home address and everything there's for you.
And Bob, please, if you will, please, I've got 15 minutes. I've got eight people to get through.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junedeff. I will be brief, but I am not short. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center, which is an organization that advocates on behalf of people with disabilities. I'll rank 3 points. The first point is that the bill before you, in many respects, in our opinion, does violate the Federal Fair Housing Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act. That does not mean that it is not curable, although it is written in such a way to be almost incurable because of the way that it blends things together. The second point is that I and my organization and many others have been involved in a number of work groups, forums, et cetera, trying to find a reasonable solution to this problem. We continue to engage in a very confrontational approach to this, and I think that this bill is representative of that. I think that there are solutions that can be crafted. I believe this bill does not do that. It may further it by letting more people know that folks are angry and they do have legitimate concerns, but I don't think that this particular bill does that. The last thing, just to demonstrate the breadth of the bill, is that as I read it, it affects organizations that provide counseling. We provide counseling to people with disabilities, including people under the PSRB, people with criminal records who have disabilities. We are located one half block from Pioneer Place in downtown Portland. We are within a half a mile of Grant High School, the Lincoln High School. We are within 1,500 feet, as I understand it, of a daycare center that's located in downtown Portland. And there are residential units across the street from our office. This just goes to demonstrate that the bill before you is very broad and that that is a blunderbuss approach to a problem that needs some more careful looking at.
So what would you say to the folks that talk about the discriminatory conduct of placement of these facilities in low-income residences, low-income areas?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I think that's a very important problem. I think that high-density placement can be dealt with through subsidizing placements, either through tax breaks or through government funding, so that we can move a fair distribution of community facilities throughout various cities and neighborhoods. But again, that has to be a very intentional policy, and I would suggest that you have to be much more careful in distinguishing between people in the criminal system and people with disabilities, because the policies and the rules are different. I think that can be done, but this bill doesn't do it.
Could you possibly, fairly quickly, if at all possible, get me case sites for the four different zoning and that sort of thing that have been struck down by the courts so that I can review those cases?
Sure, Senator Wiley, glad to do that. I'll have it to your office tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ron. Carol Dobrovolny?
Oh, you got that right. She's from my district, but I didn't used to get her.
I was studying this for a little
bit. Oh, okay.
I'm
going to name my federal phone. I did not understand.
Good afternoon. I am Carol Dobrovolny. It's a Czech name. It means goodwill.
Good. Thank you, please.
You can call that a temple.
Representing, dear senators, representing myself, North Portland citizens, and as a spokesperson for Safe Neighborhoods of For Us, the Political Action Committee I founded 3 years ago to set criteria for siting correctional facilities within Multnomah County through the initiative process, I appear today urging you to support SB 1040. This important legislation will, for the first time, establish criteria for notification, accountability, surety, and prudent siting choices when locating facilities that provide monitoring or services for Oregon's criminal and drug-addicted population. Living in Multnomah County, I've witnessed the burgeoning number of these facilities sited within neighborhoods, next to homes, near schools, and daycare centers. Constant pressure on city and county elected officials across the entire community to provide notification, accountability, and to establish criteria for siting these facilities has been futile. Parents must be entitled to information regarding locations, operations, and residents of group homes and correctional facilities in order to make decisions about places, situations, or persons their children may encounter. Sadly, our world isn't a safe place, and our children are the most vulnerable. SB 1040 will guarantee that parents receive information that could prevent a tragedy.
Sure.
Yes.
Thank you. I know you're reading fast, and you are very good. At least you have your copy of your testimony. And I think that cutting you off with that particular last sentence is a good idea. Let me ask you this. Is Dennis also with you?
Dennis is.
Is he here?
Yes.
He's signed up. Could you come forward, please? Hey, he can read the other hand. How would that be? Are you both
that's
together?
Statement. Pardon me?
You both? Okay. And Dennis, sit on, please, and brief.
Yes, I'm Dennis Cheapers. I'm from St. John's, Portland, Oregon. I lived in the community that Senator Wild spoke of that put the parole office in without notice and without informing the immediate residents. And I'm astounded that the people that are speaking against this bill do not recognize how important it is to note, just to get notice and information about what's going in next door to you. How are you ever going to have an informed citizenry if you don't get notice and information before the decision is made? And that's, I think that's a real fair statement of where this bill starts. And I'm astounded that people can recommend striking this bill out of hand. Very educated people are talking here and saying, we want to maintain status quo, strike this bill right out. No notice and no information. And I'm astounded at that. And I will try to, I want to thank you guys for working on this so hard. I know it's a difficult problem. And I do recognize there's merit to what people are saying about privacy and ADA. I'm pleased to hear Senator Wild ask them, how can we amend the language of the bill? There's got to be a synthesis here someplace. And I know it's going to be difficult to work for that. I think it's a worthwhile project, and I want to encourage you all to go forward with it.
Well, thank you very much. Questions? And I apologize, Cheryl, but we're going to try to get to you soon, don't we can.
Okay.
We get through it in just a moment. Sylvia Cady.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sylvia Cayley, and I'm with the Oregon Law Center, which is a not-for-profit law firm that represents low-income people in civil legal matters. And we are opposed to SB 1040 as it is presently written. And I will just say that I would like to reiterate the comments made by the speakers before me that have expressed concerns about the definitions issues, and I will go even one step further to say that with the definition of facility and counseling, we might also have to include schools and child care facilities in the group that would have to provide notice. I'd like to throw one other federal law into the mix that I would like to bring to your attention, and that is the rather new federal Adoptions and Safe Families Act of 1997 that requires that parental rights of a parent be terminated if the child is out of the home for 15 out of 22 months. And I would like to commend various agencies and departments in Oregon who have worked very hard to try to ameliorate the problems that families and children particularly experiencing. We've spent a good part of this session trying to
protect $20 million for alcohol and drug treatment. SDF, which is Services to Children and Families, has done exemplary work in providing upfront treatments and support so that children do not have to be removed from families and put into foster care. And I'm concerned that this bill would have a chilling effect on siting for residential treatment facilities for mothers and their children, and we'd have an awful lot more children in the adoption line, and we could see that.
You guys do a lot of advocacy for low-income folks.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a solution that we can craft in the bill that addresses the issue of saturation siding in low-income neighborhoods?
Mr. Chair and Senator Corcoran, that was my third point I wanted to raise. For the last year, there's been a work group, a meeting with Senator Kate Brown on this very issue. I don't think any of us would say that there isn't a problem in the Buckman neighborhood, and a lot of it has to do with funding that allows various agencies to buy facilities, land and whatnot, to establish these facilities. There needs to be more funding. We are very interested in having agencies talking to agencies about where they're putting their various facilities, and we support that and want that to be ongoing. We just don't think that that can be accomplished within the language of 1040 as it presently exists.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I've got two more folks, and then a third of the CA cuts and through. I may not get to you, but I think we can get your information in writing if you'd be so kind. Thank you very much. Evelyn Margotha. And then next will be Michael Roche. I should be the last one to after the city here. And Evelyn, I'm sorry, I tried to get...
That's okay. I'm short. Oh.
Okay.
Want to say hello to this?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Okay. I'm Evelyn Melville. I'm from Portland. And I'm not with any organization. I'm just a common native Oregonian neighbor. And actually, Dennis Stevens was a fan, and I'm just plain hurt that the seemingly highly educated people have come against this bill. This is just common sense to me. And until a parole office located 2 hours away from me, I had no idea that something like this wasn't already in place. Without notification, it came in, and there wouldn't be a need for this type of a bill if Multnomah County Corrections didn't come in secret purposely. And you say, well, why are they doing this secretly? Because people object. And why do people object? Because they're scary. All these people, they're scary. And you say, well, why are they scary? Well, all you have to do is watch your little kids in the front yard, and you're sitting on your porch, and you look, and there's a guy next door on his front porch watching your kids, too, and you cannot find out from corrections or he himself tells you he's a predator, sex offender, in this house. Well, you know that any mother in here would be scared to death.
Well, let me check it out. You're the reason why this bill was put in this committee.
I know. It's just a common sense. And getting notification is really not that big a deal. I don't see why. I'm not understanding why there's so much objection to it. I've had to go through a lot. That's all.
He's going to go up.
I know, that's the bad thing.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is Michael Roach, and I live in the Multnomah neighborhood in Portland, Oregon. I am here as a representative of the Southwest Neighborhood Association, which is a coalition of 16 neighborhood associations and 3 business associations in Southwest Portland, representing approximately 60,000 people. In March of 1999, the board, by absolute majority, voted to endorse this bill with 2 amendments. The first amendment is that there should be statewide standards set for security agreements, and that the burden should not be put on the back of individual neighborhood associations ad hoc to attempt to wrestle with what is adequate and what is not. The second amendment is that there should be an ongoing education process by governmental bodies, private providers, working with neighborhood associations to address siting facility problems and mental health problems that the community faces. I have also been a member of the task force mentioned to over the past year meeting, and I'd like to state for the record that many elected officials, including the mayor of Portland and certain county commissioners, have made a very good faith effort to try to resolve these problems through voluntary methods. But I'd like to end with just two quick quotes, if I may, why I'm here and why I don't think that's going to work. The first one is from an article of Linda Stamato in the National Civic Review titled In Their Own Backyards, Community Organizations and Citing Conservations. In the conclusion, she writes, in quotes, if agencies are afraid to deal with the concerns of neighbors, if they stonewall and refuse to supply information, and if they remain disinterested at distance, they exasperate the perception of threat and feelings of distrust. Ties within the community and between its members and governing bodies will suffer. Communications will be impaired, and public confidence will be eroded. I suggest to you that that is occurring, and that is why over 80 neighborhood associations, including the most liberal area, my area, in the city of Portland, are forcefully behind this bill. The second quote, and I'll be finished, is from a meeting I attended recently on the task force. And the speaker, and I'm reading out of a newspaper article, but I was also present at that meeting. The speaker is Neil Burroughs of the Network for Behavioral Health. They're a private provider that takes high-risk offenders in Portland. His quote is that people deemed disabled because of mental illness, even those who have committed criminal acts, they should not be part of this discussion. Now, my point is that voluntary compliance is not going to work because the private providers out there that are doing this do not want to have a discussion with the community, do not want to notify. And the governmental bodies have got to get off the dime and give some firm direction to those providers, or there's going to be increasing problems. There has been many instances of psychiatric review board patients getting loose. In October 1966 in Gresham, Oregon, in an adult home, a sexual offender molested two children, resulting in a lawsuit. 2 months ago, a psychiatric review patient on work release went to Vancouver and raped a woman. And you've heard of, I'm not going to, you know, burden you with anecdotal stuff, so I'll finish with the saying we have in Southwest Portland. To get a stop sign, you need three deaths. My question to you, gentlemen, is how many rapes of children and how many deaths is it going to take before we get notification, at least the same as we get with criminals? Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Sue, you've got a couple of minutes. You want to make a brief statement? We're kind of straight off, but so you're the last person on my list, so...
Very, very quick. The Department of Corrections. The notification issue is certainly one which we comply with. We all know that super signing requires public hearings, and we do information hearings as well. Perhaps this bill was not intended to reach to our secure institutions, but it does. Section 2 is particularly troublesome. If we end up noticing the extent of everyone in our system, we have roughly 8,900 today. That's a problem. So we respectfully are asking to be removed from this. We do certainly comply with notice. We have prison advisory committees, which are established. We work with communities after we are located. That's an ongoing conversation. And I'll leave it right there.
How many clients do you say you have?
Roughly 8,900 today.
Any idea what it costs, like notification or something like that?
Individual notification? No, I do not, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Sue, thank you very much. For that person who signed up to testify, and I thank you folks for kind of cooperating with the chair on this issue. We'll bring this bill back and try to get some more work done to us. In the meantime, the sponsor, I think, has got some maybe he can talk to you, Mike, about some issues or concerns that you had, and you can talk with Mr. Senator Wawa. We are adjourned.